This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good evening and welcome, everyone. So tonight we're going to look at the poems of the first Buddhist women called the Theragatha. And I'm not a scholar, as many of you know, but I have loved these poems for many. I realize it's been a while that I've been looking at them since this book came out by Susan Murcott in 91. The first Buddhist woman. So she is my main source of translation and commentary on the Theragatha. Thera means elder women, women who have grown old in knowledge. And Gatha, as we know, means verse, stanza, or song. One scholar referred to them as utterances. I like that, utterances. So these were senior ordained women, and they may not be, the scholars are not sure if they were actually written by women, although women who have read the poems say a woman definitely wrote this poem. But it's not definite, although some say there are some things, some of the poems seem to be true, that they were from the women who were present at the time of the Buddha. So they were there with him, studying with him. And then there's women who they found were working with, they never met the Buddha, so it already showed that women were studying with women and were learning from women teachers. So when I first encountered them, I remember I would just read them like poems, and then I began to, and I would get a lot of images. So there was a lot of details in the poems. If you read them, there's a lot of details. So they, like any good poem, they invite you, the reader, to imagine. That's what brings a poem alive, is our imagination from these details. That's, and we create the meaning in a way. And so I began to paint the situations. So, you know, when Patakara is bathing her feet, I loved imagining, did she have hair? Was she a nun without hair? How did she bathe her feet? And so I would try and look at what the poem was saying and come up with an image of what I thought that nun looked like. And so that's how I entered them. And, you know, having to give a presentation makes you read a lot more and research a lot more. So I was trying to learn how to read them. And it's said that they may have actually been sung, that they were songs. And when a community of women would sing, just like many people who work and would hum or sing as they were working, it was a way of bonding, to sing them together. Memorization was an important part of it. So that led me to singing them, just using kind of like how we do a chant. I would just make up my own verse, and I got a Shruti box, which is from India, to accompany the tones. So maybe we'll do that later. Um, And then other people began to sing these poems. So there was yet another feeling that was given when a man sang a poem that the woman wrote, or a young woman sang it, as opposed to an older woman singing it. So each voice would give it a different feeling, a different meaning, who was singing it. They are great poetry, and they should be read as poetry, and let it speak to us in our time. Now, in this pamphlet that we got, it says they deserve to be called great because some of them are great literature. They are literature in the way that Ezra Pound meant when he said, literature is news that stays news. I like that. So some of the Theragatha do seem to be news that has stayed news, and that is part of why they're able to delight us today and why sometimes they are able to change how we see ourselves. So they're meant to be read and absorbed and let them affect us. He says, any good literature generally does, it enables us to see things we have not seen before and to imagine things that we had not dreamed before. When reading the poems of the Theragatha, we can experience a surprising pleasure from the clarity and truth of the epiphanies they can trigger. But perhaps more important, when we experience such epiphanies, the poems give us a chance to be free from ourselves and from our usual places in the world, at least free imaginatively, and to glimpse a different potential for ourselves in the light of that epiphany. So these poems offer a lot of evidence of how these women lived in the relatively distant past in the time of the Buddha. And a lot of the poems, as I bring some in, are not necessarily Buddhist. They don't preach. They are much more about their situation. They're very human, so they're not doctrinally heavy. In Murcutt's book, she classifies the women some were wanderers, some were mothers, wives, old women, prostitutes, courtesans, beautiful women, friends, sisters. So all kinds of women that were in the society of that time actually went into, became ordained. So some of the common themes of the Theragatha is they are all ordained women. They're supposedly their awakening poems, enlightenment poems. And they don't go much into describing what their monastic life was like. I don't know, maybe you'll find more, and they don't talk about directly, you can find it, the methods of meditation that they were using. They don't spell anything out like that. It's there. If you keep reading them, you'll see, and I'll give you some of the poems where that might show a method of what the person was doing. They speak of how happy it is to achieve freedom. Another common theme is the friendship between women. That's a very common theme. A lot of them were friends before they were even ordained, so they knew each other before they actually came together. And these friendships that developed because they had common experiences. Some of those similar common experiences that women could share was the loss of children. So many of the poems speak to the grief of losing a child and how they had each other for support in that experience. Kind of like group support there. They speak of the significance of friendship, the kindness of strangers. So a lot of them who were wanderers or begging for food, poor, they were always, would speak about in their poems, like how someone helped them. Someone that didn't even know them would, my God, how kind, the kindness of strangers, they would share that experience. And at the in Southeast Asia, they said they would ask, what makes human speech poetry? And they called it crooked speech, like that, crooked speech. It says what it wants to say indirectly. That's what these poems are about. It says what it wants to say indirectly. They called it crooked speech. It's depending on us, the reader, to know what it wants to say. What is not said is the real meaning. We count on people to understand and recognize what the feeling is. And this gives us a kind of pleasure that it's not spoken directly, that it's indirect. So part of reading these poems is to try to find out what they are saying, to make sense of what they're doing. In the 6th century, this writer, Dharmapala, he collected some of these poems and added stories about the lives of the nuns before the poems. That's when that came about, which we have in some of our texts. So there's the life of the Thera, the elder, and then a poem. And these were the first poems were translated in Pali from whatever the original versions were. I'm not sure, but mostly Pali was, I think, in the Theravadan Buddhism, and then whatever local languages they had. At the same time, there was a collection of works on men's poems called the Theragatha, Thera, T-H-E-R-A. I thought it was interesting, this one scholar said, because they were, you know, so privileged. What did he say? He said basically their poems were about how nice it is to be in nature, and that's about it, he said. He said they were just, they exhibit male privilege. They talk about how wonderful it is to be in nature doing what they want to do. That's their poems. Whereas the women are talking a lot about suffering and grieving and just really human social issues, injustice, because, you know, they were often, it was hard for them to be alone. You know, they could be attacked, abused. It was really dangerous in the forest. So in this text that we got on page 6, he talks about that some of the basic Buddhist ideas show up in the poems of the Theragatha. He said these ideas about the nature of the world, ideas of rebirth and karma, a law of moral cause and effect, the structure, the conditions of experience and action for beings as they are reborn in samsara. They talk about complete liberation from samsara being possible. A lot of the poems have something about the light going out, like which we call nirvana when the candle is out. Also, there's a few poems that bring that up. They express the joy of the achievement of the women and their happiness and the knowledge that they would not be reborn again and by achieving nirvana. The Four Noble Truths. All is suffering. Suffering has a cause. Suffering can be ended, and there is a path to end that, the Noble Eightfold Path. Speaking of the skandhas, freedom from mental constructions that one has of oneself. The result of learning how to see oneself in this impersonal way is expressed in Sakula's verse. I saw my experiences as if they were not my own, born from a cause destined to disappear. I got rid of all that fouls the heart. I am cool, free. I was interested in this one scholar. His name's Charles Halisi. He's from Harvard, and he spoke of the women's poems as one of the features is how we ooze out within to contaminate all experiences we have of the world, born of our greed, anger, and ignorance, that we often find these dark features of our humanness in the Theragatha poems. The poems celebrate individual transformation that ends in liberation, but they give little specific instruction about how someone who wants to imitate the theorists might begin to undertake practices that can transform a person into what the poems celebrate. So, let's see, I thought first I would look at Patakara. And her story. She was the leader of a group of women who had lost children. And she tells a story where we see some kind of meditative technique she made for herself. Let's see. So, as I said, part of reading these poems is to, like literature, is to visualize. So when we go into Patakara's stora to look at what she might have looked at, how she was walking, what her husband looked like, he says we want to see with the mind's eye, fill in, adding what it might have looked like. And the story of Patakara, of course, is well known. It's a heartbreaking story. So he says, meaning comes from imagination of where this would have been, what is the context, and what it looked like. So Patakara, Okay, she was born to a banker in the town of Savathi. And she, like at that time, her marriage was arranged to someone whose rank was equal to hers. But her heart had other plans. She had already given her heart over to one of the servants at their house. They had servants and slaves working for them. So obviously that was not going to go over well with her parents, so she fled with her lover, and they settled not far away, and very soon after she became pregnant. And what was common at the time was you would go back to your place of birth to give birth, and she wanted to do that. Her husband was very reluctant because of the way they left, and he didn't want to go back because he thought he might, I don't know, get killed or taken away. But finally she said, well, if you're not going to come with me, I'm going to go on my own. So he's not going to leave his pregnant wife to go through the forest back to her hometown alone. So he went with her. And it was a very dangerous road, and she ended up giving birth before she even got to her parents' village. So they went back back home and with their baby in their arms. And then a second child was conceived. And again, she had this overcome with this desire to go back to her family home. And again, he was very reluctant because a storm was coming. And she said, well, I'm going to go. And he followed. And as they're going, this storm's kicking up. And so he puts her down by the side of the road and goes out into the forest to collect some branches to build a hut to protect their newborn, their infant, and his pregnant wife. What she didn't know was that he was bitten by a viper, and he never returned. But she didn't know why. So she tucked herself in, and she lived out the storm. And then she went looking for him and found him dead in the forest. There was her husband's body, and she sank into the ground, stricken with grief, couldn't move for a day or a night. Her children were hungry, and she roused herself, and she continued the journey. And the river was very swollen, so it had risen. And she was unable to carry both children across the river. So what she decided to do was cross one child at a time. What I didn't mention was she had her second baby out there in the woods. She gave birth while the storm was coming. She actually gave birth. That's an important part. So she had this very newborn. Imagine what she felt like. Just lost her husband and this swollen river, and she's still pressing on to get to the village. So she decided she would walk one child across and place him on the other side of the shore and then go back for the other child. So she did that. She took the child across, secured him on the other shore, and then as she was halfway going back, a hawk came, swept down, and picked up her newborn and took it away. And she screamed out to, no. And the child who was on the other shore thought she was telling him to come. So he stepped in and he swept away into the raging river. So now she has two children she's lost and a husband in a few days. So she thought, oh my gosh, where do I go? I want my family. I want my family. So she started to continue to walk on, and she met someone on the side of the road, and they said, are you all right? They noticed how messed up she was. And she said, I'm going to Savathi to see my family. And they said, you probably don't want to go there. There was a raging storm last night, and all the houses collapsed, and everyone was killed. So now she's lost her entire family, her mother, her father. And she just collapsed inside. Her eyes were blinded. Her mind lost its sense. And for days she just walked in circles, muttering, insane, no longer caring what she ate, what she wore. Her clothing fell in tatters from her body. I was driven away with, everywhere she went, she was driven away with sticks and rubbish. They couldn't stand the looks of her. And then one day she ended up at the Jeddah Grove, where they said there's a man called the Buddha preaching. She thought, okay, who's this? She just wandered into the grove, and all the monks were hooting at her and throwing clumps of dirt at her. Get out of here. Who's this crazy woman? And the Buddha saw this was happening, and he said, let her be. Let her be. Let her come in. And he said to her, sister, regain your senses. Right there, his words just pierced her heart. Regain your senses. She said, I collected my mind, and I saw that I was naked, and someone clothed me with a robe. Help me, I said to the Buddha. Hear my story. Now it is finished. For the Blessed One said, Patakara, don't think you have come to someone who can help you. In your lives you have shed more tears for the dead than there is water in the four oceans. My words had pierced his heart and let in my sorrow. Teach me, I said, and he told me of the Eightfold Path. Ordain me, I asked, so he took me to Prajapati's nuns, and they accepted me. I would practice, I would realize, and one day I would teach. So that's her story. And then her poem is like this. Let's see, there's two translations. So I'll start with this one in our booklet. Furrowing fields with plows, sowing seeds in the ground, taking care of wives and children, young men find wealth. So why have I not experienced freedom? When I am virtuous and I do what the teacher taught, when I am not lazy and I am calm. While washing my feet, I made the water useful in another way. By concentrating on it, move from the higher ground down. Then I held back my mind, as one would do a thoroughbred horse, and I took a lamp and I went into the hut. First, I looked at the end of the bed. Then I sat on the couch. I used a needle to pull out the lamp's wick. Just as the lamp went out, my mind was free. Another poem, another translation, which might give us a different feeling of it. When they plow their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right and followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? Bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed down the wick. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. And this last one, that's Murcott. This is a translation. When they plow their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right and followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? Bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. So, you have it in the book if you have it. How does it strike your imagination? Are there any parts of it that you find something about a meditation, something she might be doing with herself?
It sounds like a Zen poem. To me, that part where she's watching the water and concentrating her mind, I feel like that's our, work practice instruction, mm-hmm. Zazen instruction, and to trust that that's a gateway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, did she learn that, or did she just find that for herself? Like, that's what she did in that moment. Like, any more about that imagery about the water? It's also spilled down the slope. The water spilled down the slope. What does that feel like? Down the slope. Like, what else can water do? I mean, can it spill up? I don't know. It's very natural, right? It's a detail that it just, she watched it do what it does, right? Go down the slope.
I know in that time, water was often associated with death. So maybe she finally grieved her suffering, so she let it go, find it ultimately. So maybe
that's one person pointed that out, that it was in relation to that burden that she was carrying about the guilt of, like, she couldn't do anything about her children and her husband, and that at that moment it all just spilled out, the water. Yeah. So the poems are very direct and frank and speak about the suffering she's experiencing. Yeah, as we go. Also, the water has a power of its own that's spilling down. That's its own power.
I feel like that poem, like, contains the whole path, like, her sort of lament about, like, I'm training, I'm doing everything. Why am I not free yet? Like, those doubts. And then the way there is an effort, like talking about holding back the mind the way you would hold back a thoroughbred horse.
I mean, that's not just like whatever. That's like that's like turning a tide. So on the one hand, you have like this naturalness of the water and this effort, this great effort. And then like she goes into her cell and like when it said that she checks her bed, I just imagine she's like checking it for like spiders and snakes. And then she, you know, sits down and her mind is so like she's so ripe at that moment, like between her holding on to the horses and like, you know, watching the water. It's like there's so much in that poem that is like amazing.
Yeah.
And just like true and like related to the whole journey.
Yeah. I think that part about, you know, I've done everything right. I followed everything. Like how many of us, I'm not proud, I'm not lazy. And then this surprise moment comes. Like we practice. It's kind of like what Zuiko's saying. And she doesn't know what's going to happen bathing her feet, that the water and this, she's just ripe. And it's sort of like, what is that saying to us about how we practice and these surprise things that happen that we don't know? We can't plan. And so, you know, is it gradual? Is it sudden that we open up somewhere? She's, you know, very awake in that moment. And this checking the bed, I really experienced that. I think I told some of you, I was about to get in bed and there was this huge hairy spider on my bed. And I was like, oh God, you know, because it just was late. And so I went after it with like a jar to try, and it was doing that quick, you know, vroom, vroom, jumping around, and I was like, ah, you know. So it was really like in perfect line with the door. So I got a broom and I opened the door and I was like a golfer and I just went, poof! And I saw like the whole body just go out onto the porch. But have to remember up there to check the bed because I bet there were biting things, snakes and spiders, as we have now. Yeah, Eduardo.
I thought it was interesting how she starts speaking, you know, almost longingly about other people's lives. Mm. And some of the other poems, the voice was more resolute about having stepped away from that and almost... well, it's very explicitly negatively about the life of the senses and life out there. But I can see her somehow like daydreaming or like literally looking at the fields, like really kind of her heart tied to something outside. Mm. It was just nice to kind of, not so preachy, but actually I can see her thinking that. She says she's not proud, but she seems like she's maybe a little bit jealous.
Yeah, when they plow their fields and sow their seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. And in these poems, do you think you have to know a lot about Buddhism when you read them? Do you think they speak without it?
I was struck by the thing of collecting her mind and gathering her mind and, you know, this thing with concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse or holding back my mind like a thoroughbred. And that felt like some kind of practice, like real intentional action. And I don't really know what it's like to work with horses, you know. So what does it mean? You know, it's a good horse, right? It's not a wild horse. It's a horse that's trainable, I guess, right? That we could look at our mind as something that's that's workable, right? Very malleable, actually, very trainable, powerful and very, very trainable.
Right, she's saying help, and it's saying that mind could be heart mind, as one would do with a thoroughbred horse.
Yeah. So I don't know, but I have been struck by those words about the concentration, the gathering, the kind of bringing together.
Yeah. And that, as Shoa said, she said, while washing my feet, I made the water useful in another way by concentrating on it move from the higher ground down. So it is kind of like she's doing a meditation, washing her feet. That is her practice. That's what she's doing while she's doing it. And what do you think she looks like?
Brown.
Brown.
Yeah, picture an Indian woman.
Indian woman. She shaved? Or does she have hair? Ganju says she has hair. What color?
Black.
Black hair.
It's hard for me to imagine anyone but myself. You know, I read all these poems, and like I view it from my own point of view. You know, like I'm reading it as like, I mean, especially this poem. This one's so relatable for me. You know, she's like we said, like the first couple lines, she's like lamenting, like why not? What about me? You know, like that's I feel like that's my mantra sometimes. Like, what about me? You know, like everyone's ripe but me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so and like this idea of like gathering my mind, like I certainly I'm practicing that, you know, I'm trying, mm-hmm. you know, and it's so relatable, you know, so it's I see me.
Yeah. Well, it says the poem depends on us and what we see, and we will not see the same thing in the poem. So, anything else on? Yeah, Tamu.
I think of the Buddha working and working and working, going deeper, going deeper, going deeper, and then at that moment seeing the star. Or Dogen, mm-hmm. you know, working, mm-hmm. like being disappointed, struggling, going to China, going to different monasteries, not able, and then all of a sudden, boom. And in this, it's working in all fields, not in one particular practice, in every moment, in every experience. There's no difference between sitting and watching water. There's just that totality of just being there. And then at that moment, boom. And I also think of Einstein. Because he was sitting up on a hill over Bern. And he was looking at the clocks. And he knew he was working on something. He couldn't get it. And all of a sudden, boom. There it was. So it's a transformation of experience.
And then most of them keep going. I mean, all of them. There's more. There's that was one, and then they keep having to.
But that the depth of that sort of commitment to awareness, commitment to examining, where there's no, this is I'm examining now. I'm not examining. Everything is examining.
Yeah. Now, Patakara had a student of Patakara's I'd like to look at is Chanda. Did you have something to say? Okay. Chanda. Let's look at Chanda. So I was trying to think of these three things that appear. Let's see. So the attention given to social realities in the Theragatha always includes the endless varieties of social suffering endured by women, of course, but also endured by the poor, as in the following poem by Chanda, in which it is clear that she decides to ordain as a Buddhist nun, not out of any spiritual aspiration, but as a way of getting food. In the past, I was poor, a widow without children, without friends or relatives. I did not get food or clothing. Taking a bowl and stick, I went begging from family to family. I wandered for 7 years, tormented by cold and heat. Then I saw a nun as she was receiving food and drink. Approaching her, I said, "Make me go forth from homelessness." And she was sympathetic to me, and Patakara made me go forth. She gave me advice and pointed me toward the highest goal. I listened to her words and I put into action her advice. That excellent woman's advice was not empty. I know the three things that most don't know. Nothing fouls by heart. And the three things on the other side is three things that most don't know, called Tavija in Pali, the ability to know one's past lives, the ability to know where and why other beings are born, and the ability to know that one's own moral corruptions, all that holds one back, have to be eliminated. To know these, the three things that most do not know, is to know that one is enlightened and that one will never be reborn, will not be reborn. So I wrote a couple notes looking at this poem. What do you get from Chanda? It says, we can see in poems like Chanda's not only individual displays of compassion in worlds of injustice, such how Patakara treats Khanda in her hunger, but also the sensibility about evident wrongness that the world is this way. We generally do not see in the Theragatha any explanations of social suffering that befalls women and the poor are due to karmic fruits of previous actions on their part. On the contrary, the poems of the Theragatha often make us sympathize with the undeserved suffering of women, and this quality was surely part of why the Theragatha has that appeal for modern Indian social reformers. So, these three things: know your own past, know the past of others, like I know where you're going, and know your moral corruptions. I know myself, what I do. So, what did Chanda, what's going on in the story here?
What I was kind of struck by, and I think at first also kind of confused by, like it took me a couple times reading the poem to kind of sort it out, is that there's kind of no change in her actual circumstances, because from what I understand of the lives of the ordained at this time, they were also begging and without a home, but you know, she's already been kind of living this life for 7 years. And what she asked for is to go forth to homelessness, yes, having already been wandering.
But
that kind of shift of mind seems to kind of transform both, like, the way that she understands her circumstances, but also the way that the whole society relates to her, right? Like, the nun who's begging is receiving food,
yes,
and she's not. And I think, I don't know, that it was, I was surprised by, you know, I think I kind of have a habit of responding to this image of the beggar by being like, oh, that's the ordained life. But in fact, to kind of see that the life itself might be very similar, just a kind of different frame of mind about what it means to beg or not to have a home.
Yeah. I heard that as like, she's very interested, like, hey, what's your scam? You're getting the food. Like, I'm doing the same thing you are, but how come you're getting it and I'm not? As she watched her, you know, so she got very curious, you know. And, you know, she went up to her, and Patakara was very kind to her. But I think she was interested in watching her and seeing her, wow, I've been out here for like all this time, I'm not getting anything. What's she doing? Yeah, so these, again, this this very frank, straightforward, like, how do we live, you know?
How this is like the Sangha, because when she was alone, she was not approachable. But then when she had gotten the teachings and was kind of felt the love of Patachara, she was then a more accessible person. Mm-hmm. You know, so people would approach her then too, just because of her, she probably changed her demeanor because mm-hmm. she had gotten some teaching and love.
Right, so as you're pointing out, what is that homeless and then homeless, the other homeless that she went to?
However, to take a slightly controversial position, the nun was in a social matrix wherein people are giving her food for merit. Mm. What does that say about a suffering person not within the matrix? Mm-hmm. That's worth considering as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly. That's in there.
So the line that I found most interesting was, I listened to her words and I put into action her advice. Going back to what Nolan said, like, this really resonates with me. I think it's really difficult to listen, or I find it really, really difficult to listen. And having listened, to put it into action. And I think she sums up some of the struggle in practice that, like, you know, she's sort of reminding people that if you listen and act, then there'll be change. Mm. But I just thought that was a really sort of nice reminder to listen and act, rather than just sort of go through the motions of sort of listening and sort of acting, maybe-ish.
Mm. Right, she actually put it into action. Like the Buddha said, don't listen to a word I say. You know, test it with your own life experience, you know, see if it's actually true and functioning.
That struck me too. It really seemed very empowered, you know, that I put this into action. You know, there's a lot in that mm-hmm. that statement. And
I was just going to say, very simply, the importance of women practitioners. She saw Patachara, and, you know, hard to imagine if that were a monk that the door would have opened, so she would have been able to go through the door that way. So just very powerfully, the presence of women practitioners, which of course was kind of iffy back then.
Then I saw a nun as she was receiving food and drink. And, you know, I think about coming into practice and not knowing how to receive. And that's what strikes me, is just this ability to receive love or anything.
So is that from this poem that you just read?
Then I saw the nun as she was receiving food and drink, approaching
her.
I would take a little issue with the commentators saying it's clear that she decides to ordain not out of any spiritual aspiration, but as a way of getting food. I think if that were true, the end of the poem would be quite different. You know, I think feels to me like he has an agenda here a little bit.
Yeah,
Framing it in a certain way, which is, you know, for, in a way, a good purpose. But I think, he's shortcutting her a little bit.
Right.
I think there's a lot more to her than just that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because just in that encounter, you know, she was just curious and something hit her right away. So no aspiration. Go ahead.
I like that line, tormented by cold and heat, because in addition to, you know, whatever the temperatures she might have been subjected to as someone without a permanent shelter, it's like the cold and heat of the mind, you know, the icy, like, I don't care, or whatever, and then the fires of the passion and yearning and wanting and just the torment of that. So as we, like, imagine, like, well, what was her spiritual aspiration? You know, that she saw, I'm tormented.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, by cold and heat, like, what are, so are we talking about the weather? Because I could say, yeah, like, some people were, like, when it was 90, 100 degrees and humid, were just tormented, right? Weren't you tormented by the heat? No? Yeah, and then it gets really cold and everyone's tormented because it's so cold. And or is this, as you're saying, goes deeper to the passions and what is the heat and what is the cold and how we're living? So it's always asking about how we're living our life. Here's a different piece on Khanda from Murcott. Like the monks, we women were given 3 saffron robes, this must be later, a belt and a razor, a bowl, needle and thread, and a water filter. We were also given a hip string to wear during our menses. We were together, we were alone. If you had told me I would enter the homeless life, I would have not believed you. It's funny how things happen, how one's karma unfolds, that I, Khanda, should encounter Patakara in this life. Like her, I was born to wealth and good fortune. Like her, I lost it all. As a child, our home and all our grand possessions blew away as if on a careless breeze. Then years later, our village was plagued with snake blast disease, thought to be born of the breath of a poisonous snake. Flies died, lizards died, cats and dogs and goats, till finally humans were afflicted too. My parents, my husband, and all my children succumbed. I alone survived. So that's her story. I was in a bad way, a widow, no children, no friends, no relations to give me food and clothes. I was a beggar with a bowl and stick, and I wandered house to house in the heat and cold for 7 years. But I met a nun who had food and drink, and I went up to her and said, take me into the homeless life. She was Patakara. Out of pity, she guided me in leaving home, encouraged me, and urged me to the highest goal. I took her advice. It wasn't wasted. So another one struck me. I haven't looked at her much. Anything else about Khanda? In that poem, I wanted to bring in Ampabali. Ampabali. We didn't hear much of her. She's not one of the popular ones. She was a prostitute. She's not in your book. I took her from Murcott because I wanted to get sort of another life in there and to hear her poem. It's a long one, but I'll just do part of it. Her origins were supernatural, according to the legends. Ambapali came to birth spontaneously in the city of Vasali. Sound familiar? Who else came spontaneously? She was discovered by a gardener at the foot of a mango tree. Her name, Ambapali, means mango protectress or mango guardian. I like her already. She was so astonishingly beautiful that princes fought to possess her. The strife was settled by appointing her the chief courtesan of Vasali. Because of her, Vasali was said to have become very prosperous. Among Ambapali's patron was King Bimbisara. Like Padu Mamvati, Ambabala also bore a son by Bimbisara who became a Buddhist monk. These sons seemed to have become convincing proselytizers. Ambabali's son, too, was influential in his mother's decision to renounce the world. Ambabali abandoned fame and money to become a devout Buddhist disciple. She had never heard the Buddha preach, though he was by now a man in his late 60s or early 70s with a wide reputation and following. When Ambapali learned that Gautama was preaching in a nearby town, she went out to meet him and hear his sermon. She also invited him and his monks to eat with her the coming day. Gautama accepted, and though later that day he received a similar invitation from the powerful and prestigious Lachavis tribe, he postponed that lunch until the day after his lunch with Ambapali in order to keep his promise to her. When the next day dawned, the Buddha warned his monks to guard their passion and to be careful not to lose their heads over Ambapali. From Ambapali's point of view, the event was a great success. As a result, she built a hermitage on her land and gave it to the Sangha. It was that very place that the Buddha rested in his 80th year, 4 months before he died. Ambapali's poem was not a formal meditation, as, for instance, the meditation on the 32 parts of the body similarly seeks to bring the image of impermanence into focus. It's a serious poem, but it also strikes us, and probably struck the ancient Indians as well, as humorous. For this reason, it's the only poem in this collection which has been translated into rhyme, as rhyme seems befitting of its humor. It's interesting to note the striking parallels between Ambapali's poem and another ancient love poem, the bridegroom's poem in the Song of Songs. But compare the beauty of a woman to the most resplendent things in nature. But whereas the bridegroom, King Solomon, in the Old Testament poem can see only the beauty, Ambapali's poem emphasizes the contrast between former beauty and old age. So I don't want to say too much about what she wrote, just to give you your own imagination. So step into her poem and see what she's asking us to savor now. How beautiful you are, my love. Oh, wait, that's from Song of Songs. Here's her poem. Sorry. If you want to hear that, I'll read it too. Yeah? Okay. That's from the Old Testament, and if you want to hear that, I'll read it afterwards. Okay, hers is, my hair was black and curly, the color of black bees. Now that I am old, it is hemp of trees. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. Fragrant as a scented oak, I wore flowers in my hair. Now because of old age, it smells like dog's hair. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. It was thick as a grove, and I parted it with comb and pin. Now, because of old age, it's thin, very thin. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. I had fine braids fastened with gold. Now old age has made me bald. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My eyebrows were crescents painted well. Now they droop and wrinkled as well. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My eyes flash like jewels, long, black. Now they don't make anyone look back. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My earlobes were beautiful as bracelets, highly crafted and bright. Now they sag and have wrinkles, all right. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My teeth were beautiful, the color of plantain buds. Now because of old age, they're broken and yellow. This is the one. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. I had a sweet voice like a cuckoo moving through a thicket, now crackled and halting. You can hear my age in it. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My neck was beautiful like a polished conch shell. Now because of old age, it bends and bows. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My arms were beautiful, twin pillars they hung free. Now because of old age, they are weak as a patali tree. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My hands were beautiful, set off by rings, gold as the sun. Now because of old age, they are radishes and onions. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My breasts were beautiful, high, close, together and round. Now like empty water bags, they hang down. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My thighs were beautiful like an elephant's trunk. Now because of old age, they are like bamboo stalks. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My calves were beautiful, gold anklets I wore as jewelry. Now these same calves look like sticks of sesame. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. My feet were beautiful, delicate as if filled with cotton. Now because of old age, they're cracked and rotten. This is the teaching of one who speaks truth. This is how my body was. Now it is dilapidated, the place of pain, an old house with the plaster falling off. I'm a Pali. What does she want us to savor?
I think it's really interesting because it's the structure of a body scan meditation. Like, you know, you start at your head and you go all the way down to your feet, and then you kind of open up your awareness to your whole body and see what's there. And it's, I don't know, I just thought that was neat.
Yep.
What strikes me is that she just accepts her body in the beauty of the body and in its decay or whatever. And that actually brings me, maybe we talk later about Sumedha.
Who? Sumedha.
Sumedha's poem, when she talks about her body, it's really shocking. You know, it's almost puritanical. You know, it's just talking about vomit and pus and all that. And it's so different, right? You know, and so I was wondering, maybe it goes away.
I didn't get
away.
To that one.
I was wondering what other people's thoughts are about that.
Okay. We can get to that. Is that in this booklet?
Yeah.
I didn't read hers. Okay. But let's stay with I'm a Pali. So your sense was, your imagination was, she's not bemoaning old age. She's seeing that.
She accepts it. Mm-hmm. She's almost, it's funny.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck by when she said about the, you know, the every time that this is the truth. But it seemed like that it was the, you know, this is the physical appearance, not necessarily the truth. The truth is in the fact that once she was beautiful, or once her body was beautiful, now it's older, but that there's more there than just the appearance or physical appearance of her body. You know, that's not the ultimate truth, is the appearance of her body. I don't know, to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, like these poems invite our world. How do we see our world?
Yeah,
and depending on us to see it in another way too. Yeah.
In a similar way, it sounds like the other situations that the other poems that you read, where she was rich, in a way, she was beautiful, and she lost it all, and she's contemplating what does that really mean? I mean, I remember when I started losing my hair, and I was a young man. I said, God. Things do change. And, you know, and and other things that you lose during your life, and it flails you open, and makes you think about this life in a way that seems to counter the stories that I was told about this life. And when that begins to open up, when I begin to open up in that quest to understand beyond the stories that I was told, you know, whether it was, you know, George Washington never telling a lie, or going to heaven if I'm good, all these things, all these stories that, as a child, they seemed to be pretty solid.
Right.
And once I became less solid, you know, I began to really question and to the mystery of it all.
Yeah, these narratives, right? That's what we're looking at a lot, is like these narratives that we tell ourselves.
And the questions, for me, have never really been answered. The mystery seems to get larger and larger as I look at it more quietly and deeply, which is, in a sense, satisfying, because I feel like I'm a part of this wonderful thing that that is beyond my grasp. And it, for some reason, it does give me a solace. It does give me a satisfaction for some strange reason.
So her poem, do you have to be Buddhist to understand what she was speaking about?
No, it's human. Right. It's just human. Yeah, it's very human.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing in the poem it seemed to me was that it sort of reminded me of is that there can be a kind of, I think there can be a kind of a tendency to
at least when you're starting out, is to see this practice as sort of a way to escape the worst consequences of, you know, old age, sickness, and death, in some way, that you're provided with an out, or you're provided with a, you know, something other, and that, and I think, but as you actually, you know, as you actually get older and experience these things, these are real losses that take place. They're not insubstantial. At least they don't feel, you know, insubstantial. And that, you know, this thing about that these stories we've been told about our life, particularly like my generation, you know, hope I die before I get old, you know, the worship of youth, and, you know, all these kind of things. There was a story there, and the tendency is to want to replace what's turning out to be not a good story or an insufficient story with a better story, you know, and that if instead you're not replacing it with a story, what is it you're replacing it with, or what is that? And I think that's kind of the question, or the thing you were kind of talking about, is like it's not automatically so clear, you know, what that would be.
I hear the truth as the skillful means is that we can look at what's dying and manifest joy. You know, it's so funny the whole way through, but it's also tragic. It's it's death. That's what she's describing, is death. And she's saying, this is the truth, joy.
Mm-hmm. Change, death. Is it death? It's just talking about things change. It's flowing on, continuity. Yeah.
I wonder what others thought was her attitude, her tone. I found it very undramatic. It almost seems like Vito was saying, like a body scan. Yeah. She was just going through
it. Just reporting, right?
And I also had very strong feelings about the poem that Genjo mentioned in relation to this one.
Let's check that one.
Whereas in that one, we're presented with a repulsive vision of this woman in youth, in her prime, who is turning away from the life of the senses. Here we have the other side of a woman on the other end, who seems to recognize both things. She doesn't say that her thighs were like, you know, like the mist. You know, she says there were thighs, they were plump, you know, or whatever she said.
Now they're like bamboo yeah. stalks.
She seems to think of that moment in her life as real as the decay that she's feeling now. So that's why I wonder what others thought was her attitude towards it.
Others?
Yeah, I thought that there was like almost a kind of challenge or a defiance in it, of like partially her insistence on this kind of enumeration of these changes and the refrain of this is the teaching of one who speaks truth. Like, to me, it felt like almost kind of daring the reader to kind of actually look and see her this way after, you know, everyone was looking at her as this beautiful young right. courtesan, to say, you know, look, like this is the truth about, you know, that beauty that was so captivating for everyone. Like, you have, if you want to sort of see that, you have to also see the way that I am now. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's a kind of discomfort in even like hearing some of the descriptions or her frankness about it we're not used to. And I think part of what I loved about the poem is her kind of like, it felt almost like she refuses to be embarrassed about this. She's kind of daring you to see, you know, this kind of a woman also. Yeah.
It sounded like a reclamation, like she was reclaiming
yeah.
this. And, I didn't get the sense that it was like a loss of youth. It felt like she had this great sense of gain, like in the repetition of the truth, and mm-hmm. this truth. And the truth has like set her free, and so that's her gain. And it doesn't matter if she's young, old, or dead.
Right. Nance?
I don't know if it's because of the way that you read it. It went in such a beautiful way and an accepting way, but I was really feeling all this very much myself, as when I, as a woman, am aging, I am literally becoming invisible, especially if I'm around younger women and I'm in a crowd or I'm in a store, and it's fine. You know, that's what I'm hearing her saying, and this is someone who speaks the truth. You know, people looked back at my beautiful eyes, and now they don't. Mm-hmm. You know, and all the things that you have when you're a young, beautiful, well, I wasn't beautiful, but when you're a young woman, and then as we age, literally, we become, but it's great in a lot of ways. So, but I also really appreciate the way that you read it.
So the description of the beauty of the young woman, what I was thinking about was that TED Talk where the model comes onto stage and kind of is beautiful, and then she undresses and she's just like a normal, ordinary, boring woman, and everybody is shocked. And I think it's our perception of that beauty, and we are putting so much into that beauty. And so... I don't know what I wanted to say. Let's not emphasize too much the loss of the beauty, as it's just life. I don't know. That's how I thought.
Tiny thing to add to what Kenya was saying. I'm just noticing that she doesn't just speak of her body in youth, but also the adornment, all the gold. So maybe that's also the insistence of... So trying to make it a little bit more than maybe what it was. Maybe she was also not that wonderful.
I didn't get that part. What's it?
She
had jewelry?
Yes, she speaks of her youth, not just physically, but also the adornment.
Yeah.
That reminded me of what Genjo was saying, of the illusion around youth that maybe makes it seem sweeter.
Sumita has a long poem here, and so you can read that one on your own. You can keep the conversation going. Anybody else on Ambapali? Okay. Let's see. Why don't we take a little bit of a break? This Professor Charles Halesi offers ways to read these poems on your own. He said to ask the question, what's the story going on here? Sometimes you might need to know something about the poetic form. You could explore the poetic form so you can see what's happening in the poem. Or the poem doesn't depend on anything. This poem is an answer to a question. And you can say, what's the question, as you read the poem? What's the question here? So I'll share with you how I work with chanting the poem. And you can do it yourself with your own instruments. And Shoen will read the story of Mita, and then... I'll chant the poem.
Beloved sons and daughters, listen attentively. I was there at Vasali with Mahaprajapati. Oh, you cannot know what it was to stand before the Buddha's door with all the others of my kind and add my plea, Mitta's plea, to that insistent body. We were together. We were alone. Before that day, I lived in my father's house and wanted for nothing. We were rich with many slaves, but I was unable to bear children and so remained unmarried, invisible. I was a prisoner, not knowing how to ask a single question. Then I heard the Buddha's teachings. I was anxious to become free. I purged myself. I followed the special observances. But I could not find my way. So I went to Pajapati and asked her what I should do. "Come, Mita," she said. "Join us. Come to Vesali." I cut my hair and clothed myself in saffron. I walked until my feet bled. Now I forsake my jewels and take up my bowl.
Also in Murcott's book is the 8 special rules. I don't know if you've ever looked them up. Do you know what those 8 special rules are that the monks had to follow? I'll just read those real quick. The 8 special rules, the acceptance of which was the prerequisite to Mahapaji's ordination and the establishment of the order of nuns. They were special in the sense that they were unique to nuns only. The 8 special rules were, 1, a nun, even 100 years standing, shall respectfully greet, rise up in the presence of, bow down before, and perform all proper duties towards a monk ordained even a day. 2, a nun is not to spend the rainy season in a district where there is no monk. 3, every half moon, a nun is to await 2 things from the order of monks, the date of the upasatha and the time the monks will come to give teaching. That's the fusatsu, I think. Is that? Yeah, fusatsu. 4, after the rains retreat, the nuns are to hold pavarani to inquire as to whether any faults have been committed before both sanghas, that of the monks, that of the nuns, in respect to what has been seen, what has been heard, and what has been suspected. 5, a nun who has been guilty of a serious offense must undergo the manatta discipline before both sanghas, that of the monks and that of the nuns. 6, when a novice has trained for 2 years in the 6 precepts, the 5 precepts plus the precept of taking 1 meal a day before noon, she should seek ordination from both sanghas. 7, a nun is not to revile or abuse a monk under any circumstances. 8, Admonition by nuns of monks is forbidden. Admonition of nuns by monks is not forbidden. That's it. That's the rules. And I think she said, everything but number one I won't do. I think it was one. She said, I'll accept the others, but not the first one. She was actually, I think, getting very ill at that point. And she asked for him to come see her in her tent, which was forbidden, but he did. And she told him, I'm not going to follow rule number, we're not doing rule number one. I think that was that the only one, do you remember? I think that might have been, I'll have to check, or you can check. Okay, have your cookies. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.